the hard-won spiritual lessons of being hit by a tragic event.
Really, what happens in these moments is that you cease to have the illusion, to treasure the illusion that you control your life.
That's Jason Green. He lost his 2-year-old daughter to a freak accident. We talk with him about his memoir of the event and its aftermath. Once More, We Saw Stars. Then we talk with writer Mitchell Jackson about his memoir of growing up in an African-American community in Portland, Oregon. It's called Survival Math. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. You can go there to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. It's every parent's nightmare, a freak accident that takes the life of their child. That's what happened to my guest, Jason Green, and his wife, Stacy, in 2015, when a brick came loose from the facade of a building and struck and killed his 2-year-old daughter, Greta. His memoir of the event and its aftermath is Once More We Saw Stars. The New York Times called it a narrative of grief and acceptance that is compulsively readable and never self-indulgent. The book takes us through the decisions Jason and Stacy have to make, to take Greta off life support, to donate her organs, to balance the needs of daily life with overwhelming grief, to find a way to support each other, and finally, to have another child. Through it all, a kind of hard, exacting grace is found, as much because of the tragedy as in spite of it. Once More We Saw Stars is a remarkable book. Jason Green, thank you so much for coming on Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
You're a terrific writer, and this is such a powerful memoir. And it tells a story of a devastating accident that took the life of your 2-year-old daughter, Greta, and injured her grandmother, Susan. For those listeners who don't know what happened, tell us what happened.
So, in 2015, it was May 17th, my daughter Greta was with her grandmother. She was with my wife Stacy's mother, and they were having a sleepover so that Stacy and I could have a night out together. It had been a busy time, and we hadn't sat across a table and looked at each other and talked in about a month or two. So Greta used to love sleepovers at her grandma's, and so we told her she was going, and she got real excited. We took her up there, and she stayed the night. And the next morning, they were walking around the block. This is the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And they sat down on a bench in front of a senior center, which was also a routine. They would stop there often and talk to the residents of the building. And a piece of a windowsill broke loose. Masonry fell from the 8-story windowsill. And a large piece hit my daughter Greta in the head. And another piece hit my mother-in-law, Susan, in the legs. It was a freak accident, and Greta never woke up. We went to the hospital with her. There was a bleed in her brain. They tried to do surgery, but it was too late. The swelling was too severe, and she was declared brain dead, and we donated her organs. And on May 20th, I believe, so only a couple days later, we were back home, and she had been our only child.
This is just such an unimaginable, well, it is an imaginable horror. In fact, parents and grandparents imagine it all the time. It's just everyone's worst nightmare. You and your wife, Stacy, went to the hospital when you found out about this. Tell us about what you found there and kind of the initial process of trying to even process this tragedy.
Well, you know, we got the phone call from Susan when we were going down the elevator. We were on our way to go to a matinee. It was kind of our last little indulgence that weekend before we picked up Greta. And on our way out, we got the phone call from her, and it was from the scene of the accident. We could hear paramedics in the background. It was clearly an emergency. We panicked immediately. We could tell that what happened was grave, even if we didn't quite understand it yet. Susan was understandably in total shock, and so was having trouble telling us the story straight, but we knew we were going to meet her at the hospital. We knew that she was hit in the head. And I think when I heard that, I knew that what we were about to enter into was probably going to change our lives forever, that it probably wasn't a routine scare or a routine injury, although I didn't know the depth of it. Stacy and I drove up the FDR in Manhattan and didn't really talk much. We were just, Stacy kept repeating, she has to be okay. She has to be okay. And we got to the ER and they waved us in. And that's when we saw her on the little table in a room surrounded by doctors. And I think that we knew, and I won't go into detail. I mean, some of it is that I don't remember, which is the nature of trauma. But I would say that there was no dealing or coping or processing in a moment of tragedy that acute. In a moment of trauma that catastrophic, there is there's only a sort of existence. And all the parts of you that do all that work, emotional processing, I think they just shut down on purpose. You're not allowed to use those because it's too much. And so I have memories of that time, but not any emotional ones, because that part of you, and I think this is somewhat universal. I can't speak universally for trauma, but I can say that I think that for catastrophic loss in the moment, I mean, most people lose their memories, let alone their access to their emotions. Stacy and I were a little unusual, I think, in that while we didn't remember exact everything's, we have a pretty clear recollection. And part of that might have been that we also had family members who showed up, and all of us kind of pooled our memories when I wrote this book. So I don't know if my memory of this event is my own or just my inherited. It's almost this weird haunted version of the stories you hear about yourself when you're a little kid before you're conscious. You know, you think you remember something you did or said when you were two, but really you probably don't. You remember your parents telling it to you over and over again, because your conscious mind isn't really there to grapple with your experience yet. And I think there's something similar about acute trauma. So yeah, there was no what does this mean happening in the moment.
And you call it a kind of bubble. It's almost a protective bubble that the mind must create, almost like not feeling physical pain when you, you know, have a limb, let's say, that's been, you know, mangled.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one way to look at these sorts of moments from a very dispassionate viewpoint, if I take myself out of it and I pretend that it wasn't happening to me and that wasn't my daughter and that this isn't all my story, is I can look at that moment and think to myself, God, the human mind and body they are incredible in the way that they function in times of duress and extreme stress. Because I did go through this, and it did sort of, I could sort of feel these primal mechanisms kicking into place. I don't wish that anyone discovers these mechanisms for themselves, but maybe one of the stories I wanted to tell in the book was to sort of illuminate the way in which they do kick in, and to tell how it felt to sort of enter the bubble, to feel yourself enter the bubble. I mean, really what happens in these moments is that you no longer control your life, or you cease to have the illusion, depending on how you feel about that idea. You cease to treasure the illusion that you control your life. You are borne aloft and sort of swept along. And so in a way, there is a really hard moment after the dust has settled on the tragedy and all the emergencies have been dealt with, where you are then tasked with resuming the narrative of your life, and you have to start controlling your life, or attempting to control, or to use my formulation, if you don't believe in free will at all, you have to take up the illusion once more that you do control your life. And in some ways that can be the most painful part of the entire process, because you have to sort of assume agency again. And by that point, you're just thinking, well, can't I just be hurt for the rest of my life? Can't I just pretend that this is ongoing? You know, there's a certain, and I think, you know, soldiers, there are people who have had all kinds of acute trauma who have come away with that sort of feeling. Do I really need to be a whole human being now? And I remember that feeling very clearly when I went back to work. And, you know, on the one hand, I felt like I desperately needed to plunge myself back into a routine. Stacy and I both did, actually. We didn't feel the need to sequester ourselves away from daily life. If anything, we really needed daily life to distract us. So we both felt the need to go back to our jobs, even though we were still so raw. I mean, I'm talking 2 weeks. I write about that in the book. You know, we go back to work 2 weeks after Greta died, which, I mean, I look back at that and I say that sentence out loud and I think, oh God, how barbaric, how awful But again, that's just sort of my analytical mind working in retrospect. That's not how it felt at the time. At the time, there was nothing more reasonable feeling than doing that, even though we were aware, like, oh, this might seem weird to people. But at that point, what seems weird anymore anyway? You know, the entire world is upside down. You know, dark is light, right is wrong. You know, the entire natural order has inverted itself. So really, anything you do feels like it makes about as much sense as anything else. And we said, we need to work. So we went back to work. And for a while, that was what we needed. But slowly, other parts of your sort of brain and heart kick in. And then you look around and say, oh, my God, I can't be working anymore. But it's too late. You've kind of gotten back on the treadmill. And it's hard to just step off again. You know, I mean, the mundanity of life is very hostile to grief and trauma. It's very hostile. And I think that a lot of people join support groups because they need some way to find, they need some way to put grief and trauma back into their mundane daily lives. So you make it an appointment, just like everything else. You make it an appointment with, like you used to schedule babysitters, or like you, you know, I mean, if anything in your life changes, if you get a divorce, you know, you used to have date nights, maybe you have custody, like there's, you have to schedule it in your calendar. And so that's what you do as well. If you are grieving and you need to make sense of it in your life, is that you go, okay, well, every other Tuesday, I'm going to go to this basement of a church. I'm going to talk to other people who deal with this. And that's the only way in which it becomes sort of a part of your normal life, because otherwise normal life is indifferent. That doesn't say that people are, but normal, the flow of life as a sort of phenomenon, as a sensation, like today's Monday, tomorrow's Tuesday, the next day is Wednesday, the flow of time is completely indifferent to your feelings.
But you also say in this book, in Once More We Saw Stars, Jason Green, you say that grief at its peak has a terrible beauty. And that really struck me because, you know, like other people, I mean, I haven't experienced the death of a child, but I have experienced things that I grieved over terribly. And I always feel that I kind of attain a closer connection to the spiritual life when I go through this.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a powerful feeling. It's the closest you get to that feeling. There's not much, I mean, it sort of is this exalted place you enter, where, you know, life and death, that border is very porous and thin. And it's such a cliche. They say you never feel more alive when you're almost dead. I mean, that's like almost a bumper sticker. But like any cliche, there's something so primal in it. And anyone who has to live through that will discover its truth.
Now, your mother-in-law, Susan, Greta's grandmother, you know, she had a different way of dealing with this. She had, in some ways, it seems, I can't say more difficult because your process was incredibly difficult, but maybe a less successful way of dealing with it. Does that make sense to you, or am I just totally putting my foot in my mouth?
Oh, you're not putting your foot in your mouth. I wouldn't worry about that. It's tough to say what constitutes successful healing or grieving. What I can 100% say is that Susan's path was lonelier. She was a grandparent. There are grandparents groups for grandparents who have lost grandchildren. And it is also not beyond the pale to say that what she experienced was in some ways much more difficult. I mean, you know, having lost a child, having lost my daughter, I still do not attempt to imagine. I have never once tried to imagine Susan's trauma, because it is so different than mine. It is so much more visceral. She has a memory I will never have to have. And so, yeah, her trauma is much different than mine and much different than Stacy's. It has elements of guilt wrapped up in it that is so hard. It is its own pain. Not that she did anything wrong. I mean, on the contrary, what could she have done? But nonetheless, she was there on the scene. And survivor's guilt for people who've been in car crashes, and it's awful. And PTSD of a kind that I don't ever have to experience because I don't have the violence of the incident imprinted on my psyche. Susan's experience was so unbearably awful that I still can't really think about it too long. And yeah, I would say that her path has been in some ways darker. I am in awe of how far she has traveled on that path. In awe. I mean, truly, the fact that she watches our son Harrison, I mean, 2 days a week. And by the way, since the book has come out, this final sort of bridge that we had not crossed, we crossed, where Harrison has spent the night at Susan's as well. the fact that we can all do that, that she can do that, I think is testament to something really profound in her spirit, as well as in sort of between us and in our family. But yeah, I mean, Susan's path has been very different. My path has been filled with affirmation. I wrote this book and it's getting people to talk to me about my daughter. And in some ways, I enjoy a luxury that many parents of dead children do not enjoy. And that is a lot of people talking to me with great concern and often about my dead child. And I can only hope that some people who are in that position can gather some solace from reading a story about it. But I'm very aware of the fact that most people have to sort of live with this stuff. They live with it in silence. You know, I mean, a child's death is such like an unspeakable thing that, I mean, it's already something you deal with. If your spouse or your mother or your father dies, how many people really ask you about that person a year later, you know? And those are adults who lived their lives and whose deaths, in some ways, although they were sad and tragic and left you sad, you know, and sort of mourning, they still followed along with your essential understanding of how death goes. And even those people tend to disappear from people's conversations. Maybe you have close friends or family who call you on your mom's birthday or whatever it might be. But, you know, the grieving have a deep need to talk about the people they've lost. And when you've lost a child, a lot of people are so afraid. They're so afraid of you, or they're so afraid of what you represent, or they're so afraid of simply saying something that they think might hurt you more, that they just don't say anything to you. And I think about that a lot. I think about that a lot as I do interviews and I talk to people. I talk to strangers. I talk to people on the phone who ask me over and over, what was Greta like? How did you feel? How have you kept her alive? Because these are questions that if you know someone in your life who's lost a child, you can go ask them about that child tomorrow. And I guarantee you they will not be put out. They will be so grateful to you.
So many parents break up over tragedies like this. What kept you and your wife, Stacy, together?
I think we had a lot of similar needs, which I attribute mostly to luck. People don't know what they need in a situation like this until it happens to them. And it turned out that we both needed a similar amount of, let's see, we both needed to talk about Greta to keep her alive. Sometimes one person can't talk about that child ever again, and the other person is desperate with a need to talk about it. Sometimes one person wants to have another child, and the other person cannot think about it. And those are the sorts of life decisions that can break up a marriage, if only because you have such different needs in your life and you can't imagine how to reconcile them. Stacy and I both wanted to find a way to keep Greta alive. For both of us, that involved talking about her. We both knew we wanted another child. We both understood what that idea meant to both of us. You know, it wasn't we were just having another child. We wanted to be parents. Greta was gone, and that was it. But we still wanted to be parents. And so, you know, I think that some people also have a different idea, if they go on to have more children after they lose a child, of what that child means to them. And I think Stacy and I were, again, and I keep falling back on the idea that we're lucky, which is odd, I guess. But I don't know how else to account for that, because there's so much you don't know about the person you love until something happens. And I think that's true. I mean, anyone can relate to that, I think. There's so much you don't know about the person that you live with. You think you know somebody, and, you know, you might know them better than you know a total stranger. But at the end of the day, there's so much going on in their hearts that you can't hear, see, access at all. And it only comes up when something happens in your life. And so I think we both discovered that about each other. But I mean, it was to my immense relief. I did not know, to your point, if Stacy and I were going to be able to survive the tragedy, even as it was happening. I remember saying to my brother, well, I bet our marriage is next, because whose marriage survives something like this? I didn't want it to be next, but I was afraid it would be.
Your daughter was 2, as you point out, a time when her personality is really emerging, and also a time, and I remember this also, when parents begin to relax their constant fear about their child's survival. Then your child is killed through a freak accident. Do you feel that the process that you've just talked about of really keeping Greta in your hearts was part of what enabled you to have another child, Harrison?
Yes, I absolutely do. And even more than keeping her in our hearts, finding a way for her to live there peacefully, that was the hard work. Because there was no way we were going to forget Greta or her life. But were the memories going to torture us and burn us with pain, or were we going to find a way towards thinking of her with love, with sadness, but with love? I'm not going to say that I have figured all of that out now. And of course, I never experience anger or resentment or any of those emotions, but that would be a lie, because that's not how grief works. And I usually try to say something in an interview like that because a lot of people who talk, there's, especially when you've written something about your experience, and I know how this feels having been on the other side. You look at someone and think, wow, they've done the work, man. I'm so far away. And, you know, I think that that creates this sort of false sense of there is no authority in the world as murky and subjective as grief, and that I am just as lost on a day-to-day basis, I think, as everyone else. I tried to make some sense of what I had felt already, but what I am going to feel and what I feel on a day-to-day basis is it is as much a mystery to me as it is to you, you know, whoever you are. And, you know, I think that as Harrison has gotten older, I've been faced with a couple of moments where I didn't know how I would feel when they happened. One of them was that Harrison fell down on the slide and bashed his mouth, and blood poured out of his mouth. And I think I had played out a moment like that in my head as a worst case scenario where I would freeze up and he would look at me and he would see that something was wrong with Daddy. And in addition to hurting himself, he would get some weird sort of psychological imprint that if he got hurt, somehow I'd get hurt. And he would feel afraid. He would feel more afraid than he already did. That's something I thought about. You know, you think about, like, I think very obsessively about what my child learns from me without my being conscious of it. You can't be conscious of everything, of course. There's so much that I'm not conscious of. But insofar as I can make an effort to know, that was something I thought about. Can I not be fearful? Because no one deserves to be raised thinking the world is dangerous. And, you know, no matter what's happened to their parents, they shouldn't be raised in a world like that. And I had that conviction in me, and I had to figure out how to live like that. You know, I had these high flown convictions, but then there's the act of actually living up to them. And I didn't know how to do that at all. And yet, you know, he did it. He fell. And I think that parenting puts me so much in the moment that I didn't have time for any other emotions other than, let's get you up. Come on here. Let's check your teeth. Your teeth are okay. Okay, come here. And it just became another moment on the ground. Parenthood is very on the ground. You know, it is like battle in that way. You operate on a lot of sort of snap decisions. All right, now we're doing this. It's a lot of improvisation. And the short version of saying what I'm saying is that I didn't get triggered by that. I wasn't plunged into trauma. I was glad his teeth were okay. You know, he hadn't bitten his tongue off. But I didn't have this moment where I spiraled down a hole and Harrison could see that I was scared and all that stuff. But the reason I tell that anecdote is not because look at how well I did. It's because I didn't know that was going to happen. And I was pleasantly surprised. I said, oh, wow, that surprised me. Because it's like, I don't know. You don't know how you're going to be. I mean, that's true of anyone, let alone people in trauma. You don't know how you're going to be. You know, you can only sort of spend a lot of effort and time trying to imagine it.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jason Green about his memoir, Once More We Saw Stars. It's about a freak accident that took the life of his 2-year-old daughter while she was visiting her grandmother. We don't have a whole lot of time left, and I'd like to ask you about something that you touch on very lightly in the book, and I think that's right, because this book really is about the kind of emotional process and how you came to where you are now. But I'd like to ask you just about the building. I mean, I lived in New York City. New York has a very strict facade inspection law. So what happened here? I do know that the engineer who had done the last inspection in 2011, in fact, was arrested basically for negligence. Tell us what happened.
Well, this is a matter of public record. You can read about it on the DOI published a report. The New York Times summarized it. But in essence, he falsified his report. And there are a lot of other buildings. There aren't other buildings that I know of that have had falsified reports, but there are a lot of buildings that are in need of inspection that haven't necessarily received the renovations they need. I will say, though, and I want to be very careful talking about this because this involves the city. This is a whole other conversation. They have made a number of changes to inspection law as a result of Greta's accident. And together, they will hopefully ensure that at least what happened to Greta will never happen again.
How does that make you feel?
Nothing. I feel nothing about that. In order to live my life, I had to make peace with the meaninglessness of her death. If I think about the building and what happened and the inspection law, that, I mean, you know, believe me, it mattered to me that the law got changed. But once that happened, I don't want to say also that I was involved. We had one meeting with an assemblywoman, and I think it sort of took itself over from there. I mean, the city did an investigation, the building pled guilty to negligence. And so in some ways it was very cut and dry. And so I followed along, and I was relieved when the proposed changes that sort of we'd hoped for all seemed to be implemented. But as far as what it meant, I mean, it had to mean nothing, because if it meant anything, that means that I was ascribing meaning to the brick that fell. And the entire lesson that I took away was that life is capricious. Life can end in an instant. If it wasn't the brick, it could have been something else. I felt a sort of grim satisfaction that an I had been dotted and a T had been crossed. But it doesn't make me feel safer or less safe, because it was freak accident. I mean, that was the nature of it. It was a freak accident. And, you know, the lesson a freak accident gives you is that a freak accident can happen. That doesn't sound like a tautology or a circular statement. I mean, there's a funny sort of superstition that happens, and not funny, haha. There is a very interesting superstition that happens when children die, and I've noticed it. People try to fix that problem immediately. And while I'm sure one of the impulses is there is something horribly wrong here that must be fixed, there's also an undercurrent of, well, if we fix this, children will stop dying. Right?
Right.
It happens whenever there's some kind of accident. You know, people want there to be a reason why it happened. Because if there's a reason why it happened, there's a way that you yourself might be able to avoid it. And I understand that impulse. I mean, I feel that way sometimes, too, when I read these headlines. You know, I'm like, okay, well, do we live in a neighborhood where X, Y, and Z? Do we, you know, you scan your environment. You know, there was an accident recently, and no one was killed, but no one was even hurt, really, but it was a close call. And I remember my first thought, it was reflexive, was, oh, where did it happen? And because I wanted to know to avoid that corner or something. It's very human. And I think to speak to that is to speak to why I personally, as Greta's father, I can't put any emotional meaning into the resolution of building code law. Does that make sense? It's so much bigger and deeper than building codes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I'm taking away from what you're saying is that, you know, life happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have an illusion of control that we don't have, and that there is some wisdom in accepting that fact, not necessarily that you have to accept the tragedy of it, because
right,
that's the whole process, but you do have to accept that life happens.
Yeah, I mean, there was this line, and it's from David Kessler, and I quote him because it stuck with me. But David Kessler, who was a grief expert and someone who ran a weekend seminar that Stacy and I went to, where he talked about arguing with the snow. And it'd be like if you're pointing at snow on the ground and screaming that you didn't want it to be snowing and the snow shouldn't be there. And ultimately, you're losing an argument with reality. And some part of that clicked. And I think that there's something about that that stuck with me in terms of Greta's accident and what it did or did not mean.
You know, and finally, I think a very beautiful part of this book and the part I'd like to end on is how you feel you still have two children. One child is a spirit now.
Mm.
The other child is living in the real world here.
Yeah.
Tell us about how, you know, how you relate to your two children now and even how they may relate to each other.
It's a really good question. Particularly the question of how Harrison relates to Greta. I think that Harrison has some awareness that Greta is his sister. I do. He is about to be 3 years old, and I think that with that comes a certain new awareness of the world. You know, there's a painting in our apartment of Greta that a friend did, and he knows that that painting is of Greta. He says her name. When the book came out, we had these copies lying around, and I think he'd heard he'd heard Stacy and I talking about it, and he picked the book up and he'd say, this book is all about Greta and me. And then he'll look at me and he'll say, it's a beautiful book, Daddy, which is really adorable. Again, I think it's maybe something Stacy said, or I don't know. But, you know, first of all, it's an uncanny thing to hear from the mouth of a 2-year-old, 2 3/4, or whatever he is now. And another, I think it does signify something that he may or may not understand about the nature of the book. It's about our family. I know that at some day he's going to ask me, okay, so who is Greta and where is she? And then I'm going to have to explain, we are going to have to explain more to him about life and death. And we're going to eventually have to, unfortunately, tell him something bad happened to her, you know, and we're very sad about it. But for now, I think he understands that she's a member of our family and that he loves her because we do. You know, as far as Stacy and I, and as far as me, I guess, Greta is a sort of presence that I can tap into every once in a while in my life. It's not often, because that's not an easy thing to do, to commune with a sort of an idea of a person or a spirit of a person, if you believe in that language. I do, but I tread carefully because people don't necessarily believe that. Or they're uncomfortable with some of the words. Everyone I've ever met, though, when pressed, has admitted to experiencing something that they couldn't understand around the death of someone they loved. And I've had those moments now with Greta a number of times. And as life goes on, they get it less frequent. But you're right. I mean, she is absolutely our child, and we do have two children. She occupies a space without haunting it, at least for us. You know, as time goes on, that relationship is probably going to get harder, not easier, because Harrison's mind is going to become more adult and he's going to have more complicated questions and he's going to be thinking more complicated things than he is now. But for now, I think we're in this sort of uneasy equilibrium where he loves her, he knows her, and he's not troubled by her either.
And I agree with Harrison's assessment. This is a beautiful book.
Thank you.
Once More We Saw Stars, a memoir. It's been such a privilege to talk with you, Jason Green. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Green is a contributing writer and former senior editor at the online music journal Pitchfork. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Vulture, and GQ, among other publications. Once More We Saw Stars is his first book. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, Mitchell Jackson's powerful memoir of growing up poor in Portland, Oregon. It's called Survival Math. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. This past week, the white supremacist group, the Proud Boys, held a march in Portland, Oregon, where they were thankfully vastly outnumbered by counter-protesters. Oregon is no stranger to white supremacy. In fact, the territory was founded as a white racist utopia. When Oregon was granted statehood in 1859, it was the only state in the Union admitted with a constitution that forbade black people from living, working, or owning property there. It was illegal for black people even to move to the state until 1926. State capital Portland is regarded as a bastion of liberalism, but when Mitchell Jackson was growing up there in the 1980s, his neighborhood was beset with poverty, crime, and drugs. Mitchell's memoir, Survival Math, takes its name from the calculations he made to survive the Portland, Oregon of his youth. It's been called a dazzlingly written reckoning and an essential addition to the national conversation about race and class. Mitchell Jackson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
There are four rows of photos of black men on the cover of Survival Math, photos which you took. Who are these men, and how do they relate to the structure of your memoir?
So all of those men are men from my family, brothers, cousins, a nephew, a grandfather, and they are also featured in the book in what are called survival files. And what I did was I asked each of the men the same question, which is, what's the toughest thing you survived? And then I took what they told me and translated into a second person narrative. I used the second person because I thought it was a way to like invite the reader to empathize with what I thought might be kind of unusual circumstances for them. And then I also like the way the second person works as a first person narrator as well. So yeah, so I shot those photos. Really, it came out of me trying to address the Black Lives Matter movement and the insistent narrative that Black men were dangerous. And I thought, how can I challenge that? And one way to do that was to try to remove the context from these men and then see if someone who saw them still thought they were dangerous. So I shot them all in portraits. I made them take off what I thought were like identifying contextual clues. They all wore the same black t-shirt. I shot them in black and white, told them to remove their glasses or whatever else they were wearing. So really kind of, if I take everything away, like, what is it that you see in these black men? And then the other thing that happens inside of the book is I don't ever say which story belongs to which person. Again, I want the viewer to try to connect the story to the person and then ask themselves, like, why are they connecting a particular story to a particular person? And the files, they work as kind of segues between the different sections of the book. So they're in four photos and four stories between the different sections.
Yeah, and you know, as you've spoken here about that, it's so clear how much this is a constructed memoir. I mean, all memoirs are constructed, but you have layers of construction. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, well, one thing is I wasn't trying to write a memoir, I was trying to write an essay collection. But it just so happened, or not so happened, that a part of my kind of approach is that I'm grounding each one of my essays in some kind of personal experience. So as it happens, then I become a more prominent figure in all of the essays, which makes it kind of read more like a memoir. But I was also thinking about ways to break the form or challenge the form or transform the form. And early on, I was really adamant about using endnotes. Well, actually, they were footnotes in the beginning. I wanted to challenge the construction of footnotes. I wanted them not to be so academic. So I was really trying to push on the language, what was worthy of a footnote and what wasn't worthy of a footnote. And that was even before I came up with the concept of the survival files, which was maybe towards the midpoint of me working on the book. In the beginning, it was going to be one long essay, a book-length essay, and that was what is now, The Pose. So The Pose is really long because it was initially going to be the longest one and the only essay in there. Mm-hmm. And I thought I could get everything in that way, but the further along I got, I realized that it wasn't capacious enough to encompass what I needed. So it started with endnotes, and then those moved to endnotes after some conversations with my editor. Then I came up with this survival file. And then very late in the process, I decided I wanted to really try to, I had already had the subtitle of Notes on an All-American Family, and I was really trying to persuade readers to view what was happening in these essays in light of American history. And so I came up with the idea to make centos, which are poems constructed from lines from other poems. And so instead of using other poems, I use historic American documents, Gettysburg Address, Declaration of Independence, Star Spangled Banner. And so I took lines from there and then made these centos to frame what was happening in the different sections. So in the different four sections, there's four centos. There's also four survival file sections. So to me, it's like the whole kind of section of it is a cento, the essay, and then the survival files, and that's a whole section.
Yeah, it's a way to layer your personal history, the history of black people in America, and the history of the men in your family. For example, the first historical note in the book is how it opens. You address a letter to the first black man to set a foot in what would become Oregon, and you grew up in Portland. Tell us about that. It's kind of a shocker.
Yeah, so when I was growing up, there was never a mention of this man. I didn't find out about him until I was maybe in my late 30s. So this guy named Marcus Lopez was Cape Verdean. He sweet-talked his way onto a ship that was headed for China to do some trading, a guy named Captain Robert Gray, and got on the ship. And when they stopped for some R&R in what will become Oregon, he was out cutting grass and left his cutlass. And then some natives stole it, and when he chased them, they killed him. So I thought it was a harbinger that the first black man to step foot on what became Oregon was killed. And then, you know, later on when I found out about the kind of racial laws and the founding of Oregon and how they really founded it to be a kind of white utopia, the exclusion of blacks, it was the first state that was founded with an exclusion law in its constitution. So it just seemed even more important that I start with a letter to him, because he kind of heralded the plight of black people in Oregon for centuries.
Yeah, and it's something you draw a line to even to today. I mean, we can certainly see the relationship between that and, you know, a lot of people think of Oregon as a progressive utopia, but in fact, there's a lot of really white right-wing activity there.
And, absolutely.
And even gentrification.
Yes.
So connect the dots for us.
I was just there last week, and I was at this writer's conference called Tin House. He's a professor, and I stayed all week on Reed campus, which is in Southeast Portland, and I grew up mostly in Northeast Portland. And it was like I was, absolutely like I was in another state. Mm. And we were out, and there's like a wood, there's woods in the back of the school, and there's like a pond, and, you know, people are jogging, and maybe they're hiking by. And I never saw any of that. And it's astounding that I grew up literally like 15 minutes away from there. So I think, you know, with the kind of redlining and the school policies, the policing, like you can really box a certain group of people into a particular area, and then they never leave, not because they can't, because it never strikes them that something else is possible for them. And so I grew up in that community where we didn't leave, that there was a kind of oasis for people 15 minutes away that I never, ever saw. I mean, I spent 26 years in Portland before I ever left, and I never knew that Reed College that existed in the area that Reed College grew up in. So I think that's really emblematic of Portland at large, or Oregon at large, is how you can have this kind of segregated community and then have this almost utopia for other people outside of it. And if you can extrapolate that, and probably for many other cities in America, and then also that it's not by happenstance, it's by design that these places exist.
So tell us a little bit more about your community that you grew up in Northeast Portland. I have a sense from your book that it was a poor community. It was a community where survival was an issue, but also a lot more than that, a lot of love, a lot of connection.
Yeah. I mean, I really wanted to impress how much it was a community, how people knew each other, would look out for each other, would, you know, try to help each other out. We went to the same churches. It was a religious community. A lot of people were, you know, great migration that had came there, whose families had come to work in the shipyards, the Kaiser shipyards. And then there were so many people that came to work in the shipyards that Henry Kaiser built a small city on some marshland in Portland called Vanport. And the city flooded, I think Memorial Day, I think 19, it's either 36 or 46. But after that, everybody was dispersed and they moved into Northeast Portland And so, yeah, so those same people or the people or the fathers and the grandparents are the people that I grew up with. But there was a shift in the 1980s, like it was in, you know, probably every major city in America, where crack and gangs kind of infiltrated the city at the same, around the same time. And then that changed things for, really, it began with the guys just a little bit older than me, but it was definitely had a foothold during my generation, where it became more dangerous that the allegiances that you had built in elementary school and middle school and maybe even high school were called into question. And people started making money and being really protective of the ways in which they were making money. And, you know, guys who had a different kind of moral compass started, you know, doing anything they could to get some money. So I grew up in that in the late 80s and the early 90s.
Yeah, you say in the book, Mitchell Jackson, you say in Survival Math that you were part of the first generation of crack dealers who were children of crack addicts. So explain that. And of course, you also delve into how that says so little as well as saying so much.
Yeah. Well, my mother started experimenting with crack in the mid-1980s. I'd say by late 1980s, she was an addict. And by early 1990s, maybe 91, I started experimenting with selling it. I mean, I didn't do it full-time until I graduated from high school in 1993. And I was absolutely not the only one. In fact, I probably knew more people who did it than didn't do it. And it didn't dawn on me until I was writing this book that how that happened, that they could have been, our parents were the first people to experiment, because it didn't hit Portland until the mid-1980s. So a lot of the stuff that was happening to me was happening to a lot of my friends and to other people in the city. But then at the same time, you know, we still had this kind of loving community. People were still trying to look out for each other. So there was always this kind of dissonance with what was happening and what I believed about the people who I was surrounded by.
Clearly, this was a means of surviving, but say more about how that was a means of surviving. I mean, I think people from the outside or haven't been part of that kind of look upon it with opprobrium. What are the conditions that drove you, a bright young man who did well in school, to do this?
Well, it was really a part of, you know, my mother's addiction and the way in which it was affecting us financially. You know, when it almost sounds cliche that, you know, the lights will be cut off sometimes, or you couldn't pay the rent, or you had to move, or you didn't have money for this or that. And so I just wanted to get out on the other end of that. And I also had two younger brothers who I didn't want to see struggling in the same ways that I apprehended we were struggling. And so the further along my mother got in her addiction and the kind of more precarious our financial situation seemed, it just seemed like the easy way to do something. And I think I also was taking the easy way out by doing it. I mean, I could have got an after school job, though I also was a basketball player and really committed to that back then. So it was hard for me to imagine working. But yeah, I mean, it both seemed a necessity and then something that was also not the last resort. I could have done something else. But once I started making some money, that changed. You know, then it's the lure of, oh, I know I can do this again, which didn't happen until I was in my late teens.
And you got arrested once. You had already been accepted into college as a scholarship student. You had a brilliant way of kind of finagling that.
Yeah.
And then so you were able to basically postpone, you know, kind of take a gap year.
That's a nice way to put it.
And then when you got out, what was that transition like to be in college after having gone through what you'd gone through?
It actually wasn't that much of a transition because I went immediately back to college. Mm-hmm. I paroled in July of 1998 and I was back in school. I don't know, they're on quarter, so maybe it was September or late August of 1998, and I had already been preparing myself. That's actually where I started my first book. The residue years was while I was incarcerated, so I had started writing I was reading what few books they had there, which was a new practice for me. Mm-hmm. And so when I came home, I had already conditioned myself that I'm going to be a student. And also there was a sense of desperation in getting back into school, because I knew if I wasn't in school, it'd be very easy to end up back in prison, or at least to start selling drugs again, which at some point would have ended me back up in prison, at the least.
Right, at the least. I mean, you could have ended up dead, and in fact, you do question how you managed to avoid the fate of a hash mark, as you write, in the city's criminal homicide tally, or also the fate on the other end of being a killer.
Right, was reflecting on how many times I'd gone home and heard about a guy who was prone to violence, who had been rumored to have killed someone or had done it and spent some time for it, and how some people spoke with them with a kind of reverence. And I was really trying to, investigate why people who I thought were good people would speak of another person who had taken a life with that kind of reverence in it, and then trying to investigate, what was the paradigms that we held that allowed that to happen. And I think that's not something we think about, but I guess we do in terms of war, right? Mm-hmm. Like if a soldier goes off to war, then if he's in combat, you expect that he's taken a life at some point or another. And we view that with a kind of reverence because we're on the right side. We think of a war. And I guess I use the term, I use war kind of ideology in thinking about that as well, because, a gang member kind of feels himself a part of a nation. And so it makes it easier to contemplate that kind of violence, because it is really us against them, and you have a different paradigm from them. And there's a kind of valor in it for gang members at some point.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting analogy or connection that you make between gang warfare and nationalism. And I was reading today, before this interview, Claudia Rankine's essay in the New York Times asking white men about white privilege.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a terrific article. But she talks about the notion of, that black people in this country are not afforded space, that white people want to deny space to black people. And you talk in the book, Mitchell Jackson, In Survival Math, you talk about how gang warfare is, it's warfare over turf, over space, over claiming space.
Yeah. There's a Sreenan's What is a Nation, mm-hmm. where he's saying that how you become a nation is you define your boundaries. And then you ultimately obtain some kind of, you can become a nation state by obtaining some kind of autonomy. And so the gangs, they get to define their boundaries, right? Like, what hood to go into or what hood not to go into. And if you don't know, they'll soon teach you what the hood is. But then they never get the other means to create this autonomy. So they're like defining their boundaries inside of the boundaries that someone else has really enforced upon them. So they never can actually become a nation, though they kind of, like other people who have lesser means, they make do with what's inside of it. But then again, they still have some of those same kind of principles, right? Like they have a leader, they have rules, they have consequences for breaking those rules. Then there's this idea that a nation coheres mainly from shared suffering than from shared successes. And so because there's so much violence and so much oppression, that it actually makes them a tighter knit group, in the same way that, if, say, America's attacked, then the American armed forces mm-hmm. cohere against whoever they believe is the attacker.
And you also turn your eye on intersectional oppression, and this time with you as complicit in the patriarchy. You say you are, in fact, I think you use the present tense, a, quote, terrible, awful, despicable caretaker of women's hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And you go through a process of making yourself accountable. Talk about, what is the men on the scale, which is how you you classify yourself as part of that, and how you dealt with this whole other issue in survival math.
Yeah, well, the men on the scale are basically the hierarchy of emotionally abusive men. And I started thinking about that. I read an essay in Esquire about a man who was basically laying out his paradigms for cheating. And I was really struck by the fact that he didn't talk about the fallout and how much he had hurt people. And then I started asking myself, you know, questioning my own kind of history and challenged myself to not only do what he did, but also to talk about what the fallout was. And it was one of the last essays that I ended up revising. And because I had already applied a historical context to every other one of the essays, I also wanted to historicize the essay. So then I went back and like tried to examine where this kind of behavior or thinking came from, which took me all the way back to classical Athens. And then much later on, it felt very heavy in my voice. And I thought if this is a space for me to kind of provide some kind of understanding or succor for the women in my life or for women in general, then I have to let women's voice enter the piece. And so that's why I decided to interview my former partners or at least invite them to talk to me. And a few of them said yes. And so I told them that I would transcribe what they told me without editing and just put it in there.
So you gave voice to women who so often are denied a voice about this kind of oppression. Exactly. What did you learn from that?
I think the greatest lesson I learned is how the hurt never goes away, that it can carry on, and also how much previous harm makes a woman susceptible to these kind of abuses, really. And so, you know, it really makes you kind of stop and think about what kind of, you know, as a father, what kind of young woman are you creating? And then also, you know, how you cannot add on to some previous trauma.
Right. Do no harm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it also then goes into, I think, one of my favorite parts of your book, Survival Math, and that is the part about revision in life and in writing. I mean, you teach writing.
Yes.
I have to say, I was so inspired as a writer myself in reading about this. So tell us the connection between revision in your life and revision in your writing.
Well, I studied with this guy named Gordon Lish years ago now, like 2008. And one of his like most important tenets is this idea of recursion, which is looking back to move forward. And you don't just look back, you look back at what's valuable and then you carry that forward. And so when I was thinking about this revision essay, I thought, wow, that's not just a tactic for the page, it's a tactic for how to live, that you look back, evaluate your circumstances, and then you carry forth what's valuable, and then you try to leave behind what isn't. And again, because I was also reflecting on my circumstances, which is not disconnected ever from my community, I started thinking about the guys who never got a chance to apply that as a strategy of living. And that made me start thinking about other kind of strategies that I use in composing or revising my own work, and then how they might, those ideas might speak to people who don't have a chance to make those same kind of decisions. So I think, you know, it's great to be able to make a story and to think about these things in terms of creating fiction or nonfiction. But then it's also great, maybe even more valuable, to have these as a way to look at the world. And I think if the strategy doesn't work as a way to look at the world, then it probably is not that great as a revision strategy, because we're also looking at the world and our work, you know. So I think the ones that I find are most helpful are the ones that do both.
Yeah, you have three steps: a way of seeing, organization and expression, and mechanics and format. We don't really have time to go into those, but I'm struck by the way of seeing, because revision is not just revise, but to revision.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, as writers, we get stuck in, like, the minutiae, you know, commas and colons, and, you know, you might make a little small edit, but I think a lot of times if a story isn't working or a project isn't working, you have to reimagine how it's structured, what voice is it in. You might have only two or three lines that stay and everything else goes. And I think that takes a kind of bravery to be able to pursue that, which also means it takes a kind of bravery to pursue that in life, right? That imagine all the things that you've known that haven't been working. Like, you have to reimagine how to kind of move through the world. And that's a scary thing. I'm not saying that I've done that, but I think, you know, ultimately some of the things in our life might require that.
Yeah, and I imagine that you have done that, and I think the testament of it is in this absolutely stunning memoir, Survival Math. Mitchell Jackson, thank you so much for this really fascinating and profound conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mitchell Jackson, talking about his memoir, Survival Math. In addition to Survival Math, Mitchell S. Jackson is the author of the 2013 novel, The Residue Years, as well as Oversoul, an ebook collection of essays and short stories. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.